What's happening, everybody? You're now tuning into the Producer's Corner with Spud Too Tight, and I have another hot show for you today. On the phone with me, I have a very talented and gifted musician. He is truly an innovator when it comes to performing and recording with his musical talents, and also has done extensive work as a session player. Please put your hands together and welcome smooth jazz bass guitarist, producer, and composer, Gerald Beasley. How's it going, Gerald?
Hey, Spud, I'm doing well. How are you?
Oh, man, I'm doing good, man. Doing good.
All right.
Well, Gerald, man, thank you so much for taking your time and coming on my show and chopping it up with me, man. You know, I'm a huge fan of your work, man. It's just truly an honor to have you here with the show.
Man, it is a pleasure to hang out with you and you know, talk about music. It's always fun talking about musical projects, especially with music people, so it's definitely an honor.
Oh, man, thank you, man. You know, I'm a keyboardist, producer also, and, you know, like you say, man, just having the conversation between one musician to another, man, and, you know, it's truly inspirational.
I agree.
You know, a couple of tracks I want to talk to you about, Jared, that you've done before I get into the questions, man. Shango on the Fast Track and Traveling Light is probably one of my favorite tracks that you've done.
Okay, thank you so much.
Yeah, especially Shango, man. That's a really funky track, man. I'm a funkadelic myself, and, you know, that just had a lot of flair and edge to it, man. So,
well, you know, that Shango, that was from my first album, as you mentioned, called Look Ahead. And through the years, I had been exposed to, you know, a lot of African hand drummers or musicians who had played African instruments. And so I thought, what would it be like to put some of that kind of energy and instrumentation in basically a jazz funk track? And that's how that one came about. And Traveling Light it has a great groove too. That's my most recent contemporary jazz from my most recent contemporary jazz album called Your Move. And that's a tune that basically Chuck Loeb and I wrote in the studio. And being a producer, I know how you know how that is. There's some songs that you kind of labor on by yourself, and there are other things that kind of come out of the heat of one musician collaborating with another. And that's how Traveling Light came about.
Wow. You know, I had the pleasure of interviewing Chuck Loeb, man, and he's just, you know, a genius on the guitar, man. And, you know, just his ways of playing and you know, just his direction where he takes it, man, it really takes it to another level, man. That was just an excellent combination of you two both on the track.
Yeah, and you know, for me too, it was great to take off the producer's hat, at least for about half of that particular album. I had produced all of my previous seven albums, and I said, you know what, it'd be nice to kind of take a break and kind of share that responsibility with someone else. And I couldn't have picked anyone better in the contemporary jazz world than Chuck. I mean, he's so experienced. Like you said, he's a genius. He's a genius as a guitarist, as a composer, and he's a Pro Tools fanatic. And
yeah.
But he's just also, you know how it is, being a producer yourself. A lot of what we rely on you guys for is your judgment and your taste and the ability to be objective and the creativity. So he brings all those things to the table.
Yeah, I agree with you there, man. You know, Jared, how did you start as a bass player, man? You know, I always like to talk about the musical journeys, man, of, you know, how when we started as musicians and, you know, the evolution of where we are now, becoming a seasoned player as you are, man, with, you know, with the performances you've done and the CDs that you've put out in the past.
Well, for me, I was blessed to have a family that was always very, very supportive. In my immediate family, we didn't have any musicians per se, but ever since I could remember, I was always asking for an instrument. And lo and behold, in my preteen years, I got a bass for Christmas, and my family said, well, one of my dad specifically, if you're going to play this thing, you're going to have to take lessons, you're going to have to practice. And he didn't say anything to me because I just ate it all up. You know, I was just in love with the instrument right away. In fact, I was already learning to play things the first day I got it. It was just, you know, I was fortunate that I found the instrument that really spoke to me. And grew up in Philadelphia and playing in a lot of, playing in a lot of, like, funk bands and even playing in some rock bands. I mean, we would play stuff by Cream and Santana, and some of the horn bands of that period, like Blood, Sweat, and Tears, and eventually discovered jazz, and that kind of just changed my whole world around, my entire mindset, because I found a music that where you could really be as expressive as you want to be. And certainly it wasn't a music that I, or a genre that I understood at first, but I connected with it just on a creative, expressive level. And, you know, I've been very fortunate to work with people in jazz like Grover Washington Jr. I was in his band for a number of years. The great Joe Zawinul, being a keyboard player, I know you know his work.
Oh, yeah.
Founder of Weather Report. I worked with him for about 8 years. And, you know, a lot of other important people who were influential in my career along the way.
You know, it's always something, you know, how people get into jazz. You know, I think being a young musician myself, not too young, I'm in my mid-30s, but, you know...
That's young.
Yeah, well, you know, I consider myself young, you know, consider all the veterans and the experience that's out there. You know, I still feel like I'm a baby, you know? But, you know, it's cool, man, that the maturity level of where jazz can take you is endless. You know, I feel for me, I really had to grow into... an appreciation and to really develop my ears and skills to get into the smooth jazz market. And like I said, man, this really takes your creativity to another level, because then you can really fully express yourself as a musician, really bring all your, you know, your nice chops and the fancy chops together in your compositions, and, you know, just kind of bring everything together. It just really works at the end of the day for me.
Yeah, I feel the same way. And certainly, I love the improvisatory element. The fact that you can improvise a solo that's one way in one direction one night, and you go to a different club or a different city, and based on what you feel, you can change what you say, as opposed to a, let's say, a pop song where people fully expect you to perform it or sing it the same way night after night. The expectation with jazz is that it's going to change from performance to performance, even from moment to moment. So there's a freedom that is really beautiful once you start to understand how to express yourself in the jazz format.
I agree. You know, one of the things I feel that you've pioneered, the way you do your bass solos and chords on a bass, you know, coming from a traditional, maybe one finger, two finger style bass style playing, you've really taken it to another level, man, playing six string for one. And the way you do your bass solos and chords, you know, it's just almost like a guitarist in a way. I mean, you're carrying the rhythm and you're doing your solos on top, man. That just takes a lot of skill and a great ear. And you've definitely been demonstrating that to its fullest.
Well, thank you. I mean, for me, one of the things that I noticed somewhere along the line is that the piano, first of all, is the ultimate complete musical instrument, because the piano, by its very nature, it's defined as a percussion instrument, but you can play it very melodically. It's a great harmonic instrument. You know, you can play these large chords. You can simulate orchestration with a piano. But I thought, you know, being inspired by piano players, I said, well, maybe the bass's role can be beyond just being the bottom one note at a time supportive role, because you have these notes that you can play simultaneously. So I started getting into, and inspired by a lot of other bass players, by the way, I started getting into just trying to explore what I could do with bass as a chordal instrument. So to me, it has some of the same kind of beautiful capacity or capabilities that a piano has. You can play it very melodically, especially having a six-string bass, because you have an extended low and high register. So in that high register, you can play the most beautiful melodies. You can also play these rich, thicker chords. So now you get into a harmonic role. And of course, thanks to people like Larry Graham and Louis Johnson and Marcus Miller and all these amazing, very funky slap players, we know that the bass is one of the ultimate rhythm instruments. So it really encompasses three of the most important aspects of music that we listen to: rhythm, melody, and harmony.
Right. You know, with the six-string bass, Gerald, what is the tuning on that? Because I play a little guitar and a little bass, and the tuning that I'm used to is the EADGBE. On the bass, that six-string, what's the tuning on that, man?
Yeah, the most typical tuning is with a low B, below the E that we're used to. It's a low B, and then the normal four strings, E, A, D, G, and then the extra, or the sixth string, is a C string on the top. Hmm. So it extends the range, quite a bit. And one of the first players that I heard play the six-string bass was Anthony Jackson. And if your listeners don't know that name right away, he's kind of a studio legend, but he's famous for the bass line on OJ's Money, Money, Money.
Okay.
For the Love of Money. That's Anthony Jackson. And he's really probably the one to bring the six-string bass into the forefront. And after him, I would say perhaps John Patitucci, who was an important part of Chick Corea's electric band.
Yeah.
And then so for me, I've just been trying to, I guess I look at myself as a musician. I try to think of myself not just as a bass player, but, you know, as a composer and as an improviser. And so I don't, you know, like a lot of people say, man, it sounds like you're playing the guitar, or it sounds like you're doing this, or it sounds like you're doing that. And I don't think about bass technique as much as I think about the overall musicianship, and really what I want to say as an artist that's going to touch people and move people. And in the studio, how can I make the song work and that sort of thing. Not, I guess what I'm trying to say is I'm not so much focused on virtuosity, although I think musicians, as musicians, we have a responsibility to take our instruments as far as we can.
Right.
But certainly the music always comes first to me.
Definitely. The melody is always the foundation that, you know, that we create off of, you know. And like I say, ability is great, but sometimes if you're inexperienced and you get into the virtuosity side of it, it becomes less melodic, sometimes more technical. You know what I mean? And, you know,
yep.
Just maintaining that melodic structure is key, I think, you know, any musician's goal.
I totally agree.
You know, I come from a church background, Gerald. I've been playing keyboards for my church for about 17 years, directing and doing a lot of compositions and remakes, playing covers. And, you know, the benefits of being in a church environment, you know, practicing your chops on stage, you know, it was really my first audience as a musician. And, you know, what I felt the benefits I gained from was the ear for improv and picking up songs with my bandmates and reading each other on stage. You know, give me some of your experiences being a session player. And I know you also come from a church background also, man. And, you know, how is that translating well for you when you're on the road touring?
That's a fascinating question. I think I kind of came to gospel music kind of from a different perspective. My uncle is a legendary gospel singer, late great Ira Tucker from the Dixie Hummingbirds. And so from my earliest experiences was playing in the studio with his with the Dixie Hummingbirds, and with him when he was producing a gospel records. So before that, I had sort of a schooled background of having, you know, studied formally. But when I got into sessions with him, I had to put some of the academic approach to music behind, because, you know, the Dixie Hummingbirds, they're coming out of the great gospel quartet tradition. They would, almost like jazz musicians, they would change the songs from one take to the next. You know, a section might be, the first time it might be 12 bars. Well, next time they might feel a little different. It'll be 13 bars.
Wow.
And I'm sitting there, you know, a kid trying to write charts and thinking like, oh, what is it? These guys, they know what they're doing. And then thankfully I knew enough to keep my mouth shut and just and just watched and learned. And what I learned was that the music wasn't what was on the written page. The music was what came out of their hearts and souls, and the way that they served God through their music, and that their particular idiom allowed them to change it as they felt it. So all I had to do was really open my ears and listen. So I like you, I kind of had that that background of having to listen and learn by ear. But by the time I got to play with my uncle in those recordings, you know, I thought I was hot stuff. I thought I knew something about music. Well, they really showed me that there was a lot more to it than what I thought. So, you know, I'm grateful for all those kinds of opportunities. Man, I've had the experience of playing in straight-ahead kind of situations with people like McCoy Tyner, smooth jazz, contemporary jazz, even avant-garde jazz or free jazz. And, you know, I played some R&B tracks with people like Gerald Levert and Teddy Pendergrass. So each of those situations requires you to be just a little bit different, as you know. You kind of have to adjust to what the music is. So whenever I walk into a session, I try again to not throw myself or my own ideas out there before I kind of really listen and see what is required in that situation, because every situation is a little bit different. So I call it looking for the center. You know, in every musical situation, there is a center to it, or an essence, that when you grab that, it's almost like a key unlocking a door, then it makes the track or makes the song really work. If you don't find that, or for me, if I don't find that, I'm usually off the mark.
No, I agree. You know, you mentioned that center, man. You know, a lot of times for funk, it's always the pocket. You know what I mean? I think a lot of guys are great technical players, but, you know, like you say, you try to get them to find that center where it just kind of dismeshes together. I mean, it's almost like it should have been there a long time ago. It was meant for that spot and that track to be there in the deliverance of their playing. And, you know, sometimes with, you know, inexperienced musician, they can kind of bounce around it and, you know, they're delivering their expression. But you say finding that center, man, that's really the key.
So absolutely. And sometimes it could be as simple as, you know, if you're playing a ballad, you know, you might find that just if I hold the notes to a certain length, it makes the song work. If I cut the notes a little bit short, all of a sudden the song doesn't work. So I get into those kinds of really detail of serving the song to make sure I know what that center is and making the song work. And like you so well put it, you know, not worrying so much about the chops, because it's very, very rarely is it about the chops. It's usually about, you know, what's the groove, how does the groove relate to the bass line relate to the drums, is the bass line somewhat more melodic? Is it a deep bass line? Is it something that's percolating and upbeat? Is it choppy? Is it a funky thing? Is it a reggae bass line with a real behind the beat but wide, deep sound? So those are the kinds of things I look for to try to understand before I even play a note. Try to get into the vibe of it.
You know, when you're layering for any of your studio sessions, or maybe on your own CD, Gerald, do you do any type of layering of bass recordings, like overdubbing yourself and maybe adding some extra chops on top of your leads of your bass?
Occasionally, that's not typically what I do. Usually what I like to do is I may have a very simple bass line underneath just to kind of hold the bottom.
Okay.
And then with my live band, what I'll often have the keyboard player actually play the bass line.
I'll run a synth bass, I got you.
Got a synth bass, but play a bass line that's not going to really interfere and get in my way, but then have the ability to kind of float on top of that. So in the studio, too, sometimes I'll have the keyboard player actually play the bass line. For some reason, I like to keep it somewhat pure and not have layers and layers of basses. I like it to feel a little more honest and real.
So it translates into live environment, right?
Exactly.
We can get carried away sometimes, man. You know, you're in the studio for so long, and, man, it's a good lick, but, man, try to play that live is virtually impossible sometimes if you do the layers.
Exactly. Well, the other thing about layering with bass is that you have the sonically, the fundamental of a bass note takes up so much space in a track that you have to be careful about layering, because as you know, you have the fundamental sound, which is like if we're playing a C, you have that part of the sound that sounds like C, the note C. But meanwhile, there are all these overtones that you don't necessarily hear, but they're in there. You know, those other upper partials. You'll have the fifth, you'll have a G that's in there, an E that you can maybe faintly hear in there, and all these other tones. So the lower you go, the more overtones you have. But once you start combining these notes and all these overtones, if you're not careful, you have what some folks call a hot mess.
Sure.
So I try to keep the layering really to a minimum for not just, not for the sake of being honest, but also to make sure that, it's kind of a clean approach to recording.
Got you. You know, Jerry, with your experience in the game, been in there for a minute, man, and, you know, really coming out with these exceptional compositions, you know, I want to talk about your signature bass lines with Ibanez guitars, man. You know, I had a chance to view a video clip of, you know, how it was put together, man. Give me some details on how that, you know, that companionship and relationship with Ibanez formed and making your own bass line, man.
Yeah, I've been with Ibanez over 20 years. I actually played their first five string that they ever made. I was one of the bass players that tested the instrument, and that was when that relationship started. And, they supported me throughout the years, both in making instruments for me and supporting my bass boot camp, our instructional project that we do every year. But we finally decided it was time to introduce a bass that was a signature model, exactly like the instrument that I play. What's unique about my six string is that it has a relatively close spacing, meaning the spacing between the strings is a little bit more, a little less like a four string bass, and a little bit more close together, almost like a guitar. And so when you're describing me playing chords, that's part of the approach too, that I can reach all of these notes. Even though I have fairly large hands, I still like to stretch out and play these bigger chords.
Yeah.
So people now, that they've seen the bass on the market and tried it at the NAMM show and places, they're falling in love with it and finding that the instrument is so playable. You know, the other thing about bass guitar design is that a lot of the early ideas about the bass guitar was kind of transferred over between the upright bass and the guitar. So it's been a slow evolution in terms of the bass having its own unique design and its own unique aesthetic in terms of the woods and all the materials that go into making it. So anyway, in working with the Ibanez company, they were really anxious to include all of my ideas, and I worked with a luthier out of Japan who came here and hand-picked woods for the instrument and worked with me closely on the design to make sure it was something that was, you know, of a high craftsmanship and something that was also very practical for bass players, but also something very beautiful. So if I had to describe the sound of it, I would say it's a sound that's full spectrum sound, meaning you have nice deep lows and very sweet highs and sweet mid-range, and that just about all the frequencies are there, and it's very playable. And what I was looking for in my design of the instrument was an instrument that really sings. You know, we don't think of bass as singing,
all right.
But I really wanted to have a bass that sings, and they really helped me achieve that.
No, it looked really impressive, man. You know, you mentioned one of the things in the video clip, having that beefy bottom end. You know, like I said, I play a little bass, and sometimes the bottom end is just a little hollow, some of the axes that I played, and, you know, just without, you know, giving some EQing and, you know, getting it through some nice mic pre's, just running it direct sometimes, it doesn't really give me the bottom end that I'm looking for, and it looks like you got a nice EQ settings on there for the pickups, man. That was really cool.
Yeah, that worked out really well. I mean, we also collaborated with a company called Aguilar that makes my amplifiers, and they make a nice onboard preamp that really helps get those deep lows that are nice and beefy and controlled. It's fun talking bass stuff. I'm talking bass stuff with Spud. This is hot. I'm loving this.
Good deal. Now, when you're recording, Jira, I mean, are you just using the basic mic pre that's on the bass, or are you using another signal chain, you know, going in?
Yeah, I'm using a mic pre by a company called Ready. The model is called the Ready.
Okay.
It's a single tube preamp, and it really adds a nice, really gentle coloration to it, but it really fattens up even more, but in a way that doesn't add really any kind of harmonic distortion that would be a problem for making a track clear. So it's really beautiful, made by a company called A Designs, and I love it. In fact, I use it on the road too.
Nice.
So that's, you know, my weapon of choice in terms of mic pre's.
Now, are you going into a DAW system, or are you doing the analog recording to 2-inch tape?
Well, you know, I have to be honest and say 2-inch tape still sounds the best. Of course, digital systems allow you so much power over the recording process in terms of editing and, you know, recall of mixes and, you know, cutting and pasting and so on. And there are a lot of things that you can do with plugins. But yeah, I'm old school in terms of preferring the analog signal path and preferring going to tape. It's just not as practical as it used to be.
Sure.
But I still, how about you?
You know, I started in analog world and, you know, running the reel-to-reels and having external gear up, but with the DAW systems and the new converters that are out now, what I usually do is get some nice converters, run a nice mic pre through the converters, and that usually gives me a nice signal chain where it's clean. Like I say, the 2-inch tape, yeah, the levels isn't hot in the DAW world that I can get into the tape world, but, you know, like I said, having the functionality of pulling your quick mixes and, you know, using some nice effects. Waves makes some really nice effects, you know, with SSL package and API plugins and things. You know, I can dial into some nice presets.
That's really funny because when you mentioned, like, you know, the functionality of pulling up a mix really quickly that you may have saved the night before and just digging back in, you know, I was mixing something last week with my engineer, and we got, like, toward the end of the track, and he wanted, you know, I wanted a really small change. I forget what it was, but it was something really minuscule. And, you know, he made the fader move and you know, just used the automation. It was, you know, it took him 2 seconds.
Yeah.
And I just remembered how back in the day, if you went through, you know, a 5-minute track and you got to 4 minutes and 30 seconds and there was something that you missed that you would like to have in the mix, and it was just, you know, analog, you would say, oh, well, I guess it's just not going to be on the record.
Right, maybe on the next one, man.
Maybe on the next one. You know, or I would be in bands where we'd have, you know, all four of the band members, you know, would be assigned a different fader or pair of faders or set of faders so that we could, you know, we were the automation.
Yes. Oh, man.
The mix was going down.
The manual work. Man, let me tell you, I would take a long strip of masking tape, man. I would write down the actual tracks, the vocals, you know, what presets were on the channels, because after a while, it just gets too much. You know, but with the DAW world, I'm able to just type in the tracks, you know, vocal 1, channel 1, and guitars on channel 8, and I can see it and, you know, close out the track, open it, and it is there for me, and, you know, be able to save my presets, you know, certain presets I use for vocals and maybe just for trimming down the master mix. I can just kind of name my presets and apply it to other mixes, and it just really changed, you know, my mixing techniques big time.
Yeah, I could definitely see that, and you know, and just kind of, yeah, the whole housekeeping part of it, right? It becomes so much easier. I mean, the idea, you know, going back, and I've had to do this, go back and try to recreate analog mixes. It's really, I mean, I don't care how well you write it up. You just never get it quite the way. But first of all, using outboard gear, you know, you never quite get it set up the way it was before.
Oh, no,
you
know? It changes sonically every time.
Exactly. So, but, you know, there is something to be said, again, going back to the, you know, how music sounds when it hits tape, you know, what it does, that kind of, I still love it. Just don't have a chance to do that too much. But who knows, one day I'll get back to doing one of those records, you know.
Yeah, I hear you, man.
Old school, 2-inch tape, four guys, two faders each doing the mix.
Wow. That's retro. You know, finding your zone as a musician, Gerald, man, do you find that in the studio where you really can take your time with the compositions? Or is it being on stage with your band members and feeding off the energy of the audience?
I grew up performing long before I ever stepped into a studio. And performing always meant more to me. There's something about, that process of feeding off band members, you know, that energy, and then the energy you get from an audience. There's something about that the studio just cannot compete with. What I do like about the studio in terms of the recording process, I like the fact that you can really stand back after, committing yourself to a long period of time and digging into a piece of music. You can stand back and say, you know, that's something that I did or something that we did. You have a product, a tangible product that you can hold in your hand and know the blood, sweat, and tears that went into making it. You know, there's something very, very satisfying about that. I only know one way to work in the studio, and that's work really, really hard, even with all the tools that we talked about. And just as a side note, at one point, I thought that I would do more production, and I had a few production projects, meaning outside projects, and I realized that that's something that I don't take on many outside clients for production, because I only know one way to do it, and that's to really give it my all. So I end up sometimes, taking the whole project to heart as though I'm the artist and not just the producer.
Sure.
And putting so much love into it and so much effort into it, and those nights where you're sleeping in the studio, or that's kind of how I work. And I said, well, man, maybe I shouldn't do this for everyone, because it doesn't always it doesn't always necessarily make economic sense to put that kind of time and love into a project that's not yours. So I'm careful about projects that I take on as a producer, but I love production. I love, again, that feeling of when you started with a blank page, so to speak,
yeah,
and you end up with a tangible product at the end. There's something beautiful about that.
It is, man. You know, for me, it's always the beginning and the mid-stages of the track is what excites me the most. You know what I mean? Starting from that ground up on the track. And, eventually a finished product is always cool. But it's just how it all came together and along the way. And, sometimes you'll may get stuck on a couple of phrases that may be missing or take away a couple of phrases. But, it's just the whole building process of the compositions really intrigues me, keeps me inspired to write. So, yeah, I agree with you.
Yeah, it's almost like putting together a puzzle, isn't it?
Oh, totally.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, sometimes it's just one little piece that makes the whole thing come together.
Oh, totally. You round a couple edges off, man, and presto. Now, Gerald, what's on the musical agenda for 2011? What do we have on the plate?
This is really a special year for me, because there's a long-standing project that I've been involved with since 2001. I love the music of Charles Mingus, and so... Yeah, 10 years ago, I put together a band that does a unique spin on his music. Of course, Charles Mingus was a seminal bass player, composer, band leader, real iconoclastic figure in American jazz. And I decided to put together a band that would play his music, but the spin would be, instead of acoustic bass, me on electric bass, and instead of acoustic wind instruments, use a saxophone player who also plays iwi, the electric wind instrument, and a trumpet player who also plays the electric valve instrument, and using, instead of piano, use vibes, and the vibes player does all sorts of treatments, yes, synthesizer treatments as well as acoustic treatments of his vibes with drums and percussion. Yes. And so we've been playing that in that format again for 10 years, and now we are officially putting out our record. And so that's actually coming out really, really soon, and people can find out more about that on my website, GeraldVeasley.com. So that's my labor of love. I also put together some really cool packages that are touring this year. One is my salute to the Philly sound. You know, growing up in Philly, man, we had such a great, great period of time musically with the production and compositions of Gamblin' Huff. Yeah. And they created such a great legacy here. So I tapped into that to create contemporary jazz versions of a lot of those classic stylistics, Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes, Spinach tunes, and kind of bringing a fresh approach to those songs. And we presented our debut concert last fall, and people just lost their minds. And bring along some really incredible musicians to work on the project with me. Carol Riddick, great singer who for a number of years toured with Jill Scott. She's our vocalist, one of our vocalists. Nick Colleone, fantastic guitar player.
Oh, yeah.
Walter Beasley on saxophone, who I jokingly call my cousin, even though he's Beasley with a B, I'm Beasley with a V.
Sure.
And the phenomenal Will Downing on vocals.
Oh, wow. That's another industry veteran.
He is really quite a legend. And so, yeah, we put that show on, and we're doing some other dates with that. And of course, my band, the Gerald Veasley Band, which, we play contemporary jazz with a... call it smooth jazz, wouldn't probably describe it properly, because it definitely has a groove, and it's definitely melodic, but with a little bit of an edge, in that we have really great improvisers in the band, and we kind of go for it. We take charges, take chances. The music's not polite,
right?
But it is certainly melodic. So those are my three major projects, performing wise, and educationally. As I mentioned earlier, this is the 10th year of my bass boot camp. And that's an instructional event that we started off doing in just one location outside of Philadelphia in Reading, Pennsylvania, which is the home of the Berks Jazz Fest.
Yeah, I think I read that online, man. There's heavy hitters in that one.
And it's a great festival, and we partner with them every year to put together a fantastic event. This year, we've got, as our bass instructors, we have some really heavy hitters. I like that word, heavy hitters. Dave Dyson on bass as one of our instructors, who plays with Mike the Buddy's Pieces of a Dream. We've got Rhonda Smith from formerly of Prince's Band, and Jeff Beck. She's so funky. Adam Nitti, who's an amazing one of the young lions on the bass. Anthony Wellington, one of my favorite instructors and bass players. And Victor Wooten will be there. We'll do a meet and greet with him. And he's also in concert right in the same venue of the bass boot camp. And my idol, Stanley Clark.
Nice.
Is presenting a concert as well. Jeff Lorber Fusion will be there. Jimmy Haslip, who is of the Yellow Jackets, he's one of our instructors. So it's literally an all-star cast of instructors, and the program itself is phenomenal. The real stars of the program are the students themselves. They've ranged in age from age 12 up to age 68. Wow. All levels, from absolute novice to pro players. We offer over 30 hours of instruction over a weekend. It is not for the faint of heart. It's not for, anybody who has an ego. Everybody checks their ego at the door, and we just work, sweat, have fun with the bass, have a great time, nurture each other, support each other. It's one part informational, two parts inspirational, and, I just love doing it. I just love doing it.
Man, that is phenomenal, man. You know, I just want to point out, man, you know, remaining that student of music, I mean, that I really think that's really going to be a successful goal that I think every musician to try to keep in mind. You know, after I know certain levels of expertise gets, you know, as we get older and better at our craft. But, you know, I've always remained a student of music. I've been doing it 22 years. And, you know, like I say, man, I mentioned earlier, I still feel like a baby, man. When I learn something new, I say, man, there's just tons of things just to learn more. So
it's endless, isn't it?
It totally really is.
You never really quite get it. It's funny. I remember, you know, when I was a teenager and, you know, I'd have a girlfriend and she'd say, where are you going? Are we going out tonight? Well, I have to practice. I have rehearsal. Don't you guys know it yet? And all these years later, it's the same thing. Like, well, don't you know it yet? Well, you never learned at all. You just, you just keep growing. And thank God I have a wife that understands.
Oh, totally.
In fact, are you married?
I am married, yes. 10 years.
Oh, congratulations. It's a blessing. I know with my wife, man, she loves to just sit and watch me practice.
Oh, yeah. Those are our biggest fans, man.
Yeah, man. She's so supportive, and that means a lot to me because it means that, you know, I have the support to continue doing and encouragement to continue doing what I'm doing.
Oh, totally. Well, Gerald, man, it's been a true honor, man, having you on the show. I would love to have you back. Talk about your new endeavors, new CDs, anything you have on the plate that's musically, man. I'm here, man. You got a spot here at the Producer's Corner.
Oh, I appreciate it, man. Continue success with the Producer's Corner, and we'll get together and jam sometime.
Oh, man, I'll be looking forward to it.
All right, buddy.
Well, you have a safe 2011, Gerald. Best of luck to you,
man. Thanks. Same to you, Spud. Bless you, man.
Sounds good, man.
All right. Bye.
And a big shout out and thank you to Gerald Veasley for coming on the show and chopping it up with me. Been a fan of Gerald's for a while, listened to a lot of his tracks, man, and it just amazes me how he demonstrates his musicianship on the bass. From the solos, man, to the chords that he plays on the bass, is just truly phenomenal as a musician. And for more information on Gerald, you need to check out his website out at www.geraldveasley.com. Again, www.geraldveasley.com. And for my past and current interviews, you can hit my website up at www.spudtootight.com, www.spudtootight.com. And I'm also available on iTunes as a podcast, so if you have a Mac or a PC, an iPhone or iPod, you can open up the iTunes store, type in the Producer's Corner with Spud Too Tight, click on my image, and you'll have a list of my past and current interviews as well. And I want to thank everybody for tuning and listening in. And for the remainder of the show, I'm going to let the track that's playing in the background close out the show. The title of the track is called Summer Kiss, and is off the Velvet CD of Gerald Veasley. And it's written by Gerald Veasley along with Herb Middleton, and it features John Legend. So until next time, you guys keep it tight. Peace.